Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 150, Wisdom Counsels and Dynamic Facilitation, April 25th, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
We're following energy, and which is psychic energy, really. Often the energy starts with a solution rather than defining the problem. In this case, we're just taking what bubbles up, and we're expecting that solutions will probably be first. We call it the purge. So we try and pull out from the person what they would do. So it's sort of like going to the end of the meeting first, because some meetings kind of talk, everybody talks and defines the problem, and then at the very end, you start talking about what you really would do. What we're trying to do is bring the really, what you would really do right up front, and then have the whole meeting to be talking from the heart about what we really want.
That was the voice of my guest, Jim Ruff. Jim Ruff is a consultant, speaker, seminar leader, author, and social innovator. He originated dynamic facilitation, which according to his website is a new way of facilitating meetings that assures creative collaborative thinking, which is now being used all over the world. For almost two decades, he has presented public seminars on this innovation. Jim also created the Wisdom Council, which is a new approach to facilitating large systems of people to work together creatively. He describes this innovation as applied to the nation and the world in his book, Society's Breakthrough, Releasing Essential Wisdom and Virtue in All the People. He's co-founder of the nonprofit Center for Wise Democracy, and for 20 years, Jim was on the faculty of the annual Creative Problem Solving Institutes in Buffalo, New York. Now, here's the interview. Jim Ruff, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. I'm really glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you here talking about your approach to facilitating meetings, because I know this is work that you have been doing over the course of a number of years and that you've evolved your own distinctive approach. And before we get into what your approach is, maybe we should start with, where do most meetings go wrong? I mean, I've been in meetings in business settings and academic settings, and a lot of the time it feels like, I don't know, they're a waste of time.
I think a lot of it, David, is in the quality of the thinking process. That what we really want to have happen is for people to find out what's best, to be listening to one another, to be creative, to be respectful. And to the best answer of all would be to have a breakthrough.
Yes, well, I think people maybe often start off with that kind of intention, but somehow they don't get there. What are the ways in which, you know, the traditional structures for meetings don't work?
Well, that's exactly right. The traditional structures are more aimed, I think, at protecting people than they are at aiming for a breakthrough. So that you try and define the problem first, and then you stay on the agenda, and you follow a linear path, and you suppress your emotions. You try not to be too passionate, otherwise people will get hurt. And so there's a lot of devices that people use to keep sort of themselves safe, I think, is basically what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So how did you come to evolve your approach? How did it, you know, take us a little bit through your own personal evolution of how you got to where you are today?
All right, if I go way back, my mother was the kind of person that everybody loved to be talking to, and my father was the kind of person that could make an argument out of any agreement. And so I think I had a natural propensity to to be really sensitive about what's happening in meetings and what's, I wanted to be like my mother. I didn't want to be like my father.
Uh-huh.
And I worked in a, as a consultant in a timber company. And, I had the opportunity, I talked management into trying a particular process of, that was called quality circles at the time.
Oh, I remember that. That was a big movement in the business world. I guess it was developed in this country, but nobody paid attention to it. And the guy who developed it, somehow people in Japan picked up on it. And,
sure did.
And Japan started producing like all these high quality cars and so on. And so then people in the U.S. got excited about it. Is that right?
Yes, that is. And there were some rules about how quality circles would happen. And some of the ideas were that management would be involved and there would be training for people. And there was a particular process people would go through. And I talked management into giving me the permission to meet with employees, but they didn't want to be involved. Management didn't, and they didn't want to have anybody go to any training or anything like that. And they basically just said, "Jim, go make these people feel better, and we don't really expect much from this."
Mm-hmm.
And what they did, in essence, is create a laboratory for me to try different group processes and group process technologies, and really to find out that they didn't work, at least in that environment.
Now, had you already had some training and different approaches to leading groups?
I had been for a number of years on the faculty of the Creative Problem Solving Institute in Buffalo, New York. It was called CIPSI.
Yes, I've heard of them.
And so I was skilled at brainstorming and helping people do, you know, synectics and different creative thinking processes. And I basically found they didn't work for emotional, the kinds of emotionally attached problems that these guys had. You can't take somebody who just hates their job and hates what's going on and say, hey, let's brainstorm some ideas to change it. It just, they don't know what to do with that. And I was also learning and thinking about Jungian psychology in my own growth process.
Oh, good. And, you know I'm interested in that, right?
So I was interested in saying, okay, well, if creativity really exists, then we ought to be applying it to the big problems that are out there. And for these mill workers, the big problems were, hey, I hate my foreman, and you know, I want that pay cut that I lost 4 years ago. You know, I want it back. And so there was...
Yeah, you're up in the Pacific Northwest, so that was a, maybe it still is, a troubled industry, right? And falling on hard times.
Well, yeah, this is all 20-some years ago at the time, but it's also gone now. I don't know that it's on hard times.
Wow.
But anyway, the process for me was realizing that I wanted to help these guys solve their problems, and I wanted to help them be creative in doing it. And that was what I saw as the goal. It's like, here you have an impossible-to-solve problem, or seemingly impossible-to-solve problem. If creativity works, then that's an appropriate match. We'll be creative. And when I tried brainstorming and those kinds of processes, it really wasn't appropriate. Was not an appropriate thinking process. And I was studying Jungian psychology at the time, and I said, well, how do I bring more of the Jungian bent into this group thinking process? And I started experimenting and toying around.
Let me just cut in. What in particular about the Jungian bent were you trying to tap into or wanting to bring into the process?
I would say that the core of it is to put the lead in the hands of the unconscious.
Okay. So you have kind of a faith and trust in the unconscious that if people were to lead from that, come more from that place, that it would take it to a good place?
Yeah. If we can release that capability, that deep interconnectedness with the universe and with life, then we'll find that there's a richer, deeper path that we're on, and one that we're in connection with other people.
Okay.
For instance, brainstorming relies on the creative unconscious to deliver ideas, but what you say, you have a superior process in play where you're saying, okay, here's the range of, we're going to work on ideas for uses of a brick or something, and you may come up with lots of different ideas and possibilities, but you're still coming up with uses for a brick, and at least an intention, or that's being held constant, and me as a participant in this process, I'm unchanging. I'm still the same person I was when we started. Whereas the Jungian process, or the what I now call dynamic facilitation and the choice creating process, people, the topic may change depending on what happens, or the whatever bubbles up, we want to create a space for it.
And what I'm also hearing in what you're saying, what I think I'm hearing, is that you want this to be more than just a conversation, that you think there's some possibility that some sort of transformation will happen in the process.
That's absolutely right. Not of each person in the process, of the facilitator, and of the situation. When a group, let me give you an example. One time I was working with some loggers out on the, and they were working on the issue of how do we get new radios? And we've gone to management. Management said no. And so I would help them start working with their passion about getting new radios, and we need new radios, that sort of thing. And in the conversation, just following that energy, the conversation, it comes up that, well, why do we want new radios? Well, we're responsible for safety. And then the big insight was that, gosh, if we're responsible for safety, then we should be able to just buy the radios. And so that was a shift that happened as they were thinking, and then they went, all of them felt empowered then to go back to management with the same request, but from an entirely different footing. Now they were empowered, saying, well, this is the situation, and we're either in charge of safety or we're not in charge of safety.
Yeah, so it had kind of moved from what might have been perceived as, we want a new toy, to this is vital for safety.
Yeah, so there was something that happened in the process that shifted inside the men, and they became strong individually and more capable about what they were doing, and they became a we.
Okay. So that's part of what you're seeking then, is to create that sense of we?
Yes. There are certain shifts that happen. Sometimes it's just a new idea about what might be implemented, but other times there's this shift of connectedness between people. Another example in the mill was this one big equipment operator would put these big logs for this other one to put through the barker, and these guys hated each other for years. And just bringing them together and giving them this chance to talk in a way that whatever bubbled up, there was never any, in dynamic facilitation, what we do is somebody will say, well, here's what we ought to do, and the other person will start to say, well, that's a stupid idea. And you say, oh, you have a concern. Let me write down this concern. And so we turn what they were going to say that was going to go against the other person into something that adds to this puzzle that we're solving together. And then the question would be, do you have another idea that might be better? And then we'd put that on our list of solutions. And so in the talking that way, these guys became best of friends.
Wow, that's great. Well, do you have some ground rules that you lay out at the beginning of a group? I know a lot of different approaches, you know, they'll kind of say, okay, these are going to be the ground rules as we move ahead here.
Yeah, we basically see that as a process. Setting up a set of ground rules is trying to get people to self-control, self-regulate. And we really don't want that. We want people to just bubble up, and the facilitator's responsibility is to frame the situation so that whatever bubbles up is an asset to the group.
Well, give me an example then, maybe of a recent project. You know, how did you start it? How did you frame it?
Well, one way to do it would be like, I'm trying to think of a recent situation, but in the Department of Revenue, for instance, I shouldn't say a climate. Let me go somewhere else.
Okay.
All right. In one organization, the group had a number of issues that they had for years, maybe 8 different issues, and we just started talking about them in this way. So I would just allow people to talk. What are some of the issues we might talk about? And they would speak them. And if somebody wanted to say, oh, that's not an issue, we shouldn't do that, I'll just say, oh, you have a concern, I'd write that down. And I would help the group find the most important issue. Which one is the hottest? And somebody, you know, I just kind of follow the energy of the group. So if there was any conflict or anything, that's pretty hot. So, and often what the energy, we're following energy, and which is psychic energy, really. Often the energy starts with a solution rather than defining the problem.
Is that good or bad?
It's good. It's good. Rather, most processes would say don't jump to solutions.
Right, right.
In this case, we're just taking what bubbles up, and we're expecting that solutions will probably be first. We call it the purge. So we try and pull out from the person what they would do. So it's sort of like going to the end of the meeting first, because some meetings kind of everybody talks and defines the problem, and then at the very end, you start talking about what you really would do.
Yeah.
What we're trying to do is bring the really, what you would really do right up front, and then have the whole meeting to be talking from the heart about what we really want. So anyway, we're sort of imagining that, the result is that people will come up with solutions first. It's not always the case, but so we're sort of aware of that and aiming for it and helping people go there so you're in charge of the world right now and you want to deal with healthcare. What would you do? How would you set it up? What would be? Or you want to deal with terrorism and you were in charge. How would you do that? And that's when people start to talk and say, rather than just harping at what is happening in the political sphere, say, they say, oh, well, here's what I would do. And then often there's a response from somebody about how it wouldn't work or how, you know, what's wrong with you. Or a lot of us have been conditioned to just not say what we really think.
Yes. And one of the things that you said in there was talking from the heart. And how do you get people to talk from the heart? I mean, you know, one of the things that we learn about meetings, at least in traditional lore, is that often they're what are called hidden agendas, which is kind of the opposite of talking from the heart.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we want to bring those out right away. So what would you do? We want to go past the pretend agenda and just say, look, here's the issue. We care about it. You are now in charge. We're going to walk out of the meeting in an hour, and all of us are going to have our hands upraised and feel really good about what happened, and you are. What would we have decided? So So we're giving this person who would normally have a hidden agenda, we're trying to just cut through it and give them a chance to just blurt out what the real agenda is.
Mm-hmm.
And then protect them so that they don't feel any, you know, there's no negative emotion from that. So whatever anybody then says that might be critical, we turn it into something that is positive and keeps the energy going forward.
Okay, I'm thinking in a corporate situation, it might be hard to protect somebody because they may be aware that, well, either my boss is in this meeting or my boss is going to hear about this meeting. Do you ever have to deal with those sorts of issues?
Well, yeah, the boss in the meeting is, we're in pretty good shape because we're going to keep everybody safe and we're going to bring everybody out. So often what we do is go to the boss first and have the boss purge. So the boss is saying what's really on his or her mind and cutting past the hidden agenda. When the boss isn't in the room and, you know, then there's a different thing. What we need to do is protect the environment so that people can speak openly and honestly. And then if it's a concern about how what will happen afterwards, then we'll deal with that concern as a separate issue. Like, what's the boss think, or, we might feel repercussions, or if any of that is, you know, happening, then
right.
Work that through.
What do you do about big talkers? You know, for years I was in an academic environment, and we would have department meetings, and we're all psychologists, for heaven's sakes. We're all supposed to know this stuff.
Yeah.
And we would just have the most awful meetings so often. And for me, one of the things that was the most irritating and challenging were what I call the big talkers, the people who would just go on and on.
Yeah, I mean, it is the hard part for us is that we want to follow the energy, and sometimes the extroverted energy is seems like it's more than the introverted energy. And so we have to be careful that we follow the deeper energy sometimes. But big talkers, you'd be surprised how if you start this process, we call it, to me, it's a different kind of thinking. It's not deliberation. It's not dialogue. It's not problem solving. It's not creative problem solving. There's just no word for this other kind of thinking that we're doing in this. We call it choice creating. So when people do choice creating, the big talkers, it takes a lot out of, I mean, we all want to be big talkers. In other words, we're all like dying to be in the mix.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are a big talker and the person says, tell us really the answer, what are you trying to say? Or this, are you selling the idea, or do you want to just, can you just tell us what the idea is before you sell it? Or, you know, in other words, what we really want is that we call it a purge, because when the person speaks it, they don't have to keep selling it. They don't have to keep talking. And so much in the big talking that happens is because people have in mind some end that they're trying to get to that they can't really just say out front. So they're talking around it in terms of really making a big play about how we define the problem, or really making a big play about which data point is actually accurate or not. We don't have to do all that because we're going to jump to the end. And it isn't that important what data points are most accurate.
I would think that a lot of the success of this would depend upon the skill of the facilitator. And I am under the impression that part of what you do is to train people to be facilitators of your process. What are the skills or abilities or talents that the facilitator needs to have?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's true. I've been teaching this now and evolving it for about 20 years, or 19 years, I guess. And so we've evolved it to a point where there is a process, a technique, some skills that people can learn, and where it's transferable and people can do it. And they can, when I say do it, they can assure choice creating as the quality of thinking in the room. One of the most important ones is, I think, to have the dynamic facilitator hold the new paradigm, hold the paradigm of of knowing that what's coming up is valuable, and that impossible to solve problems can be solved, and that we're seeking diversity and excited about, quote, disagreement. And when the DFer or the dynamic facilitator has that paradigm, it is conveyed to the group. The group begins to get it that, hey, this is a different kind of thinking here. We're not trying to solve what we know we can solve. We're trying to find where our energy is. We're trying to find those problems that we can't do anything about, that we really care about, and solve those.
So it sounds like the an important part of the process then is that the facilitator is modeling a kind of attitude and a kind of energy.
Yes. Yes, and a perspective, yes.
And then are there other sorts of concrete skills that person needs to be trained
in?
There are.
There's an ability to reflect. We call it weflecting.
I like that.
Yeah, it's really about the facilitator is really putting their brain on loan to the group. In other words, I am the group when I'm standing there. So I'm helping the group think. And so when someone says something, I don't stand there and say, does everybody agree to that? I am the group. So in a way, if I can put myself aside and help the group just be, each person be empowered to stand up and say, no, I don't feel that way, if they don't. So I'm just going with what each person says and guessing what they're really trying to say and just totally in service to the group. And that's a key ability and skill to do. And then helping people feel empowered to say, hey, that's not quite right, and then being excited when somebody has some difference, because that opens the door to a breakthrough possibility.
Okay. So reflecting, that sounds a little Rogerian to me. It reminds me of Carl Rogers and the emphasis that he puts on helping people to feel heard by being able to say back kind of what he's hearing in different words. Is that essentially what you're describing?
It is, except there's a couple differences, I guess. One is there's reflecting to the individual, but this is more a process of reflecting to the group. So you're building a group consciousness as well. So there's the two sides to this.
Mm-hmm.
And another one is just in the reflecting process, we try and guess what the person's really trying to say.
Yes.
What the group is really trying to say. And that sounds Rogerian, I guess.
Yeah. Would you say something like what I hear a saying is, or?
No.
No.
Try not to say that.
Okay. What would you say?
Yeah, because the what I hear you saying is puts me over here and you over there.
No, I said what I hear us saying.
Trying
to speak for the group.
Yeah, so rather than an individual in the group, a participant might say that, but the facilitator tries to put all that language away and just basically say the thing, say the reflection. So so we are saying that, or you are saying that, you know, just... putting out the what I hear you saying or what I hear us saying, or getting rid of the beginning language is an important aspect to this, just because it emphasizes that there's a me here, and I don't want that to be there.
Almost. Okay. So what else? Give us some more about about the rules and the structure and so on.
Well, you know,
I'm just trying to get as concrete an idea of the, and I gather that it's hard for you to make it really concrete.
Yeah, it is. I've been gradually moving to be more concrete as we go, because originally it was just like, if you can hang on to this perspective, then you can do it. And now it's become more concrete as we go. The one of the key pieces of this is, I think, and a skill that the facilitator has, is to be able to recognize when the group reaches, we don't use the word, we try not to use the word decision, we're stuck with that word, but any form of decision is actually a form of denial. So there's a, when I make a decision, I'm cutting out all this other stuff that could have been there that I'm just going to say, okay, that doesn't count anymore. I'm going to put that in denial.
Mm-hmm.
This is a different process of thinking. We're not making a decision. We actually end up with choices that we are going to do and we're unanimous about, but we didn't make any decision to get there. We actually, and that's why we call it choice creating instead of decision making. It's a process of sort of mulling at this deep, authentic level, and then where the, quote, decision, unquote, is apparent, and it's emergent. And we use the word of course. It's an of course. You know, we just look at one another and say, of course we're going to do that. It's just sort of self-evident after we think in this way.
Well, that sounds great. you can get to that point where everybody says, well, of course.
Yeah, it is. You know, the thing is it, and that's, it's out of that process that, because that is possible to do, and the one of the things that makes it possible is recognizing that the facilitator needs to recognize that the problem statement, what we're working on, has changed. In other words, rather than saying, uh-oh, we got to get back to what we started talking about, what happens is that the group shifts its energy, and now the problem has become something else. And so there's a lot of the of course, and a lot of the breakthroughs often are in, oh, the real problem is this. You know, it's just a different thing. And we can't solve the problem at that level. And I know you've started reading my book, Society's Breakthrough, but that's kind of how I got to that concept of how we could transform our society, possibly, is that in the seminars, people would work to practice dynamic facilitation. They would work on, one group would go in a corner and work on healthcare, another group would go in a corner and work on terrorism, and another group would go in a corner and work on you know, inner city crime or something. And often these groups would have these shifts and breakthroughs from the process where they would realize that, hey, this problem isn't being caused by bad terrorists or bad people. It's being caused by the system. And often this would happen, I mean, so often it would be almost embarrassing. So many groups would point to the system and say the system is causing this problem. And so over time I began to get it. Okay, what's the system? How did the system cause this problem? And what is the system? And how did we get one? And so that, following that thread, I mean, that those would be those breakthroughs that happened in the small groups. And then a big breakthrough to me was to realize the importance of the U.S. Constitution in defining our system, for instance, and how you know, how that, there's no we the people. There was a we the people when it got started, but now there's just a constitution in charge of us, and it is pre-programmed to, in a certain direction that now causes lots of problems.
Yeah, so, in your book, you talk, I remember you have some diagrams talking about different organizational structures, and there's the triangular structure, which is sort of very hierarchical decision-making structure, and then you've got what you call the box structure, which is kind of rule-governed, and then you have a circular structure. At least that's how you've symbolized these different systems, and the circle is more the idea that you've been talking about of kind of a level playing field of we looking one another in the eyes and not being governed either by the hierarchy or bound by the rules as much as bound by common concern and passion.
That's exactly right. The triangle, I think there are three fundamental organizational structures for society, for organizations, for you name it, for families. One is the triangle where, hey, I'm in charge, I'm the boss, so we're going to make, that's how we make collectively intelligent decisions. We just rely on one person and everybody else learns to be loyal. The other one is, is where we are now in our society, is we've tried to set up a system that is based on the rule of law, where it's not based on a person. It's based on a contract where the contract is in charge, and we exist inside that set of rules, and there's no we outside in charge. And then the third level of system is of this honest, authentic conversation among all of us where we evolve what the answers are or what the systems need to be and where we define the system. And I think in our society today, if we're going to survive and thrive, we need to get to that circle system. And which means moving to the next level beyond where the Constitution is in charge of us. That's at the society level. There needs to be we the people, a we the people conversation. And seeing that maybe it's easier to see in organizations that many organizations, have a triangle structure, or they might have many government organizations have kind of a box structure where the rules are in charge, and then and people say, well, hey, we voted on this, why, or they have some kind of structure in charge. Why the first group says, we just need a strong leader in here who can make the decisions, and then we'll know what to do. And the next group says, hey, we voted on this, why aren't we doing it? I don't understand. And the circle group says, hey, why can't we talk? Let's just visit and talk and figure out what we need to do here. Well, the talking that's needed to make that circle system work is choice creating.
Okay, well, it certainly sounds good to me. You can sign me up for that. What if people want to find out more about your thinking and your work? I know you've got a website. Do you want to put that out there?
Yeah, dynamicfacilitation.com is the seminars in dynamic facilitation. And our website for our nonprofit organization that's bringing the Wisdom Council to nonprofits and to society and different communities and so forth is www.wisedemocracy.org.
Okay, well, Jim Ruff, I want to thank you so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you very much, David. I really appreciate it.
I hope you found this conversation with Jim Ruff intriguing. He mentioned a couple of his websites at the end of our discussion. He mentioned www.dynamicfacilitation.com and www.wisedemocracy.org. I'll be sure to put these links into the show notes. I find myself in philosophical agreement with Jim's approach, yet after this admittedly short interview, I still don't have as clear a picture of the nitty-gritty of his dynamic facilitation as I'd like, and what differentiates it from other meeting management approaches, for example, the World Work approach about which we previously interviewed Max Schupbach on Shrink Wrap Radio number 133. Of course, that approach also left me with many questions as well. According to Jim, on his website, using dynamic facilitation, meetings are engaging, respectful, and creative. The real problems are discovered, addressed, and solved. People can be themselves and not hold back. There's no need to train participants. The group can tackle and solve impossible problems and become empowered. The group reaches real consensus rapidly without compromising individuality. Participants build the sense of community, trust, and commitment. A we develops. Individuals grow in capability, and the system grows in capability. So what's not to like there? That all sounds good to me. I especially like his concept of choice creating. What I take from that is that rather than quickly funneling down to one or two solutions, I'm picturing an approach that encourages a visioning of a wider array of choices than might first be assumed. He contrasts decision-making versus choice creating, which I interpret to be a narrowing down versus expanding the options. Here's what he says about it on his dynamic facilitation website, and I quote, "Choice creating is a quality of thinking where people face important issues authentically and creatively seeking what's best for all. It's like decision making in that people determine specific conclusions, but different because rather than, quote, make decisions, which divides people, they create new choices, which brings them together. It's a heartfelt, nonlinear cognitive process, often involving moments of seeming chaos rather than a logical step-by-step one always in control. Choice creating often happens naturally when there is a crisis and people pull together, drop their roles, get creative to achieve the impossible. Better than waiting for the crisis to be upon us, however, is to be able to facilitate this quality of thinking beforehand. Just thinking this way, even if there's no clear breakthrough, builds deep connection with others. A we," close quote. So all of this sounds great. I just want a clearer sense of how to do it. I guess if I really want to know, I could take one of his training workshops. It's probably too much to expect him to give away the keys to the kingdom in a single interview like this. If you are sufficiently intrigued, you'll find on his website workshop dates around the U.S. and in Europe and Asia.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Let us all remember what you seek is what you find. And Dr. Dave is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Exploring our spirit and our psyche, we are learning to unwind. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. We're all in your mind. We're all in your mind.
Announcements, announcements, announcements. If you've been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio for any length of time, you know that our major sponsor is Podshow. Well, they've just changed their name and henceforth will be known as Mevio and will be located at www.mevio.com. That's spelled M-E-V-I-O.com. They'll continue to support Shrink Wrap Radio and to host our content. The rationale given for the name change is that in their pursuit of advertisers, the advertisers would balk at the term podcast. Evidently, they just don't get it, don't trust it. Personally, I had hoped that Podshow would drive awareness of the podcast medium and the term podcasting, but they felt they were hitting their collective head against a brick wall. And I think they're also leaning more and more toward video, but will continue to support podcasts such as this one, audio ones, and bring us good sponsors like GoDaddy. If you're interested, you can find out a lot more by Googling MeVio, which is spelled M-E-V-I-O. In the meantime, here are a couple of excerpts from their press release. Quotes, conceived on the premise that audiences would continue to move away from TV and begin to move towards single-clip video websites, MeVio has evolved from pod shows, groundbreaking podcast and music networks, which primarily focused on downloaded entertainment. In 2007, Podshow began its move to the web by producing and distributing a broad range of episodic video and audio shows, attracting an impressive array of brand advertisers along the way and causing an explosion in growth that has resulted in the company reaching Comscore's top 20 sites in both music, where it's number 10, and multimedia, where it's number 16 as of March 2008. Today, MeVio provides its users with access to over 1 million hours of entertainment that can be played online, downloaded, or combined into channels. MeVio expects to double its roster of top programming in the next 90 days. And here's another excerpt from their press release, which reads as follows, quotes, already generating nearly 8 million unique visits a month and growing, MeVio hosts more than 15,000 shows within the new platform. MeVio also produces its own programming and plans to add 600 shows and produce a total of 50 original shows by the end of 2008. The top shows on MeVio generate millions of views every month with audiences that are beginning to compete with hit cable and television series, end quote. Well, we're not one of those top shows generating millions of listeners every month, I can tell you that. I originally signed up with Podshow, now MeVio, because I thought they'd be a winner in the podcast space. And as you can see, they are on a roll. The danger for me and Shrinkwrap Radio, however, is getting lost in the crowd. I'll keep you posted as things develop. Now, speaking of Googling things, it used to be that if you entered the search term psychology podcast into Google, Shrinkwrap Radio would be the first one up, which warmed the cockles of me heart. However, I tried it the other day and couldn't find Shrinkwrap Radio on any of the pages that came up. Somewhere in the transition from a traditional website to our current blog format, our meta tag keywords got lost, and Google stopped crawling on our site. This loss of standing has been a big blow to my ego, and I'm hoping that I've got things back to where the Google spider finds us, and we can get back onto the first page at least. In happier news, listener Jason Howard has generously transcribed Shrinkwrap Radio episode number 43, Happy Birthday, Dr. Freud, my interview with the incomparable Freud scholar, Dr. Doug Davis. Jason is now working on transcribing the interview with Dr. Kelly Bulkeley from episode number 93, Dreaming as a Bridge Between Religion and Science. There is a new drop-down menu at the top of our website that says Transcripts, and that's where you'll find these transcripts. Won't you please consider contributing to this effort that Jason has started by volunteering to transcribe one or more interviews? Just let me know which one you're taking on ahead of time so that we don't get two people working on the same one. The other new menu item is one that says Feeds. There you'll find feed URLs for the archived shows. By subscribing to these in iTunes, your favorite podcatcher, or RSS reader, you can automatically get the shows from 2005, 2006, and early 2007, which are no longer showing up in the main feed. The 2005 feed is already showing up in the iTunes store, and the 2006 and 2007 feeds have been approved and will be showing up there soon. You have to look closely, though, because they all look the same, except if you scroll all the way over to the end, you'll see they're 2005, 2006, or 2007 in the title, or not. If it's not, then it's the main feed. Contact me if you don't understand what I'm talking about here. And the sponsors for this show are MeVio and GoDaddy. Use the discount code SHRINK3 at checkout on GoDaddy.com and save 10% on your next domain name purchase.
Yeah, you should really listen to that Dr. Dave show. A lot of people are tuning in. It's
extremely popular. I've met Dr. Dave a couple times and listened to his show and liked it very much. There's a lot of good stuff there. And for those of you who are into what your mind is doing, it's an interesting little piece of your body. What's going on in your head? You might want to check it out. Shrink Wrap Radio, shrinkwrapradio.com.
Well, nothing like an endorsement from Adam Curry, who's sitting at the top of the Mevio pyramid, by which I mean he's both co-founder and president. Okay, let's catch up on some back email from listeners. Rick writes, "Hey Dave, I've been going through all the previous podcasts for your show bit by bit in an unsophisticated manner, choosing by my random interest or obligatory drive to listen to every show when I stumbled upon the shows on tarot card reading. The first show was interesting, but really served as more of a setup for the second show, in which you went over your own reading. At the end of that program, you stated that you'd like some feedback on your free-form approach to that particular broadcast." Yeah, I was there talking about how I had not written out a script for myself and was really just going to kind of free associate from the top of my head, which I still don't feel terribly comfortable doing. He goes on to say, "You did just fine, Dave, and as you go on, you'll do even better. You should not give up on refining that skill. My deceased father was a broadcaster early in his life, so I feel at least by virtue of my DNA that I can speak with some authority here. So there you have it on that score, but that isn't why I wrote. The primary reason for this correspondence is to convey how grateful I have been when you've talked about yourself and your experiences." That's great. I'm so glad to hear that, because sometimes I feel like, well, I'm being too self-indulgent. He goes on to say, "I'm in school and building a third life, one I hope will be the happiest to date, but have had lots of fear along the way about how I will pay the bills, get into a good graduate school, establish a practice, or get a position at a university, etc. However, discussions about your own personal struggles and spiritual journey have helped me see something new or see that I'm not alone in how I see the world around me. While I have all the worries I wrote about moments ago, on the flip side, I'm constantly reminded that something bigger is afoot by the small miracles along the way. I may be a slow learner because it wasn't until my mid-30s that I finally figured out how to feel connected to the energy that is called God or the universe, and because of that connection, I see God in everything now and never feel separate from Him. One of the things you said on your podcast on narcissism was that you're a bit of a narcissist yourself and that you felt that you needed to stay in touch with your understanding of that. I know that I also bend in that direction and have found that the more aware and deep my understanding of this personality trait I become, the more I am able to mitigate the negatives of that aspect of self and magnify what can be very good about coming from that place. I have concluded that to become enlightened requires that we see ourselves clearly, that we understand our dark and light and embrace who we are as a whole." Well said. "It is because of doing this that I've been able to reach out to others more effectively and affectively. I have discovered that the more honest I am with myself, the easier life is and the better my relationships are. I'm still new to living the life of faith I live now, but I like it best of all the lives I have lived to date. I just didn't understand what faith was, or I would have started earlier. I guess I needed to get roughed up by the circumstances of life and my own errant thinking before I could see my way to where I am now. Thanks, Rick." And thank you, Rick, and I couldn't say it any better than you've said it there and some of the points that you made. Now here's one from a longtime listener, Alex, and I'll just read an excerpt from his in which he says, "I'm absolutely certain that for every one person like me who takes the time to email you, there are hundreds more lurkers. With so much content on the net, it can be difficult to pay dues to all of our important sources of inspiration and information." Well, I know that's true because there's so many podcasts that I listen to that I have not written the podcasters. He goes on to say, "By the way, those are only a few of the podcasts I've listened to in psychology." He had mentioned a bunch to me. He says, I listen while exercising. I guess I exercise a lot. I've been thinking of writing a general review of available psychology podcasts as I've sampled many of them. If I ever get to it, I'll be sure to let you know. I've already reviewed your shows positively on two forums I frequent and will take the time to write a review on iTunes soon as well, as I know it's important to you to have a high ranking. Yes, it is. Do it if you haven't. I don't think you have a whole lot of competition, though, in the quality department, but letting podcast listeners know that it's important so that they don't waste too much time wading through the less inspired shows out there. Well, thank you so much for that, Rick, and I appreciate all your communications, and I hope you did write that review in iTunes. I didn't check, so I'm not sure. Listener Elon writes, Hey, Dr. Dave, I just wanted to thank you for your podcast. As I'm going somewhat mad emailing you at 3 a.m. trying to meet this deadline on this animated project that I have, can't bail out on, your show gives me a reason to sit in front of my computer so I can get this thing done in time, hopefully. For someone's eyes who are usually busy with drawing and graphic design instead of reading books, your podcast provides a service to the parts of my brain that would otherwise waste away with my limited music library. Just to let you know, I've subscribed to your RSS feed through Google's RSS Reader. For a long time, it didn't update since the last show of 2007. I thought that maybe you took some time off from doing the show. I visited your site some weeks ago and was glad to see that it was my RSS reader that was the problem and resubscribed. I don't know if you did any technical tweaks on your side or maybe the RSS reader was upgraded, but I thought you should know that there was a problem for, in case there was a problem for any of your listeners who use the Google RSS reader. Thanks again, Elon. Geez, Elon, I wonder if that problem had anything to do with the search issue that I was mentioning earlier. I'm not sure. And then we hear from longtime Israeli listener, Anna, who writes, Hi, David, how are you doing? Getting lots of new listeners for being listed on top with iTunes? Are you still on top? Well, not still listed on the main podcast page as I was for a short time. That did give us a significant bump in numbers. But I'm still listed, the Shrink Wrap Radio logo is still prominently displayed on the higher education page in iTunes, at least in the U.S. I've discovered that depending upon what country you're in, you see different pages and different views. And I've also discovered that in my latest version of iTunes on the Mac, at the bottom, you can choose what country you want to view it from. So that's an interesting feature. Anna goes on to say, I have finally gotten or come around to listening to 3 episodes. He had gotten busy and hadn't been listening as regularly. He said, 2 you recommend, the happiness hypothesis and conscious living and dying, as well as the one with the robotherapist. I thoroughly enjoyed your show again, and after such a long absence, it has become much clearer once more what a talented radio, podcast, and interview person you are. Great stuff. And then he puts in a link to one of his latest reviews. And you can find his reviews at http://anna.blogspot.com, and that's spelled A-N-N-E is a man.blogspot.com. He says, hope all is well. Good luck, Anna.
Hi, David. My name is Elisha Goldstein. I'm a psychologist, also the author of the CD series Mindful Solutions for Stress, Anxiety, and Depression, and also Mindful Solutions for Addiction and Relapse Prevention. The latter being endorsed by Dr. Alan Marlatt, who you might know, being one of the leaders in the addiction field up at the University of Washington. In any event, I have a number of really interesting things going on, and I'd love to speak to you and see if I can get on Shrink Wrap. I was just interviewed a couple times on Vicki Sinclair's radio show, and would love to talk to you about that.
And indeed, we did talk about that, and I'm happy to report that Dr. Elisha Goldstein will be a guest quite soon on a future show. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemails on Skype where I'm called Shrink Pod, and you can leave voice messages using the MyChingo button on the site, and you can leave a voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks again to my guest, Jim Ruff, for sharing his work on wisdom counsels and dynamic facilitation. My next show will build somewhat on this topic by focusing on relationships in the workplace. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.